Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You can go into certain places now in Europe for the first time and have a meal just based off of your iPhone swiping your Bitcoins. This is really catching some traction.
The problem with Bitcoin is what I see there is the same problem that we have with mutual funds. When mutual funds were becoming very popular, they were actually listed on the stock market in 66, and that's what that 66 crash was, when the first time it hit 1,000 and crashed. Why? Because what happened when you listed the mutual funds, let's say the net asset value was $30, they would get bid up to 50 because, oh, they're making good money, whatever. And then when they would crash, it was still net asset value 30, they'd go to 20. Okay? So people were losing money tremendously on these mutual funds. So that is when regulation came in. The SEC finally understood, well, okay, this is the problem. And then they took mutual funds off the exchange. So now you invest in a mutual fund and you go in and out basically on net asset value, eliminating that problem. So that's the problem of Bitcoin, all right? To be long-term sustainable, it's probably not very good. But the idea of a cryptocurrency that's not in a situation like Bitcoin where it can get bid up well beyond, what it's, how is it a store of wealth if the wealth can become from 1,000 to 2,000 and then crash? And what if the guy who bought it at 2,000 then gets 1,000? That's not a store of wealth. It's just a speculative vehicle. That's about it.
I'm taking a different perspective, that wealth is created by scarcity, and the blockchain structure guarantees scarcity. We don't really have the technological power yet to break the blockchain structure, so there will always be demand. Sure, yeah, I can see the tulip aspect here. I can see the dot bomb.
All I'm saying is that if it's open up so that it's not necessarily limited, so you don't get these excessive booms, and it becomes an actual store of wealth, then you're going to have a cryptocurrency that can replace, sovereign currencies, paper currencies, or whatever, whatever you want to call it at that point.
You make a great point. Maybe we could agree, just as, the VCR, it didn't bring an end to the movie theater. I mean, we still like to go to movie theaters from time to time, but it did create its own market space. Just as Amazon did not replace the shopping mall, although it looks like it's starting to, it did create its own domain.
I think, cryptocurrency is where we're heading long term. I'm just talking about the structure of how you have to open it up so it is a stable currency as opposed to just a speculative boom. Because then you have a lot of people who can just come in and they don't know, and they're just going to buy the high and then lose half their wealth.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. Be careful with this. It is speculative. What I'm trying to point out is the value created in transactions.
Yes, that's a separate issue which I think can be resolved by a good structure that's not a limited Bitcoin, so it gets bid up or bid down. It should be a store of wealth, so that, okay, fine, $10 is $10.
There's really a lot more to the cryptocurrencies than I think people realize. They think, oh, it's just buying or selling Bitcoin or mining. Now, with Ethereum, you can vote. You can have it tied to any currency in the world that you want. You could have it tied to the stock market, interest rate sensitive Ethereum tokens.
I think that's, look at the world. Not just the United States and the Fed and the latest thing Trump said or tweeted or not. These are just distractions. And it's the trend is always set in motion globally. And that is what you have to understand. And politicians don't get this either. But the 87 crash was very simple. G5 started in 1985. And what they do, they stood up and they said, we want the dollar down 40% to help trade. The Japanese just bought one-third of the national debt. Now you're going to tell them you're going to take the currency and drop it by 40%? Don't you think they might sell? this is what I mean. We have people in government positions that have no concept whatsoever of how markets even trade.
Is the solution that we need a Department of Financial Management, similar to the Treasury or the Fed, that offers real world at the trading pit, at the trading desk information?
I think so. I mean, you know, often I may be the only person out here saying something, but, you know, the reason for that is I get tons of emails from people in the industry. You can, you know, if they're working for, you know, various different banks on Forex desks or whatever, you have to sign a confidentiality agreement. You're not allowed to speak to somebody like you, because if I worked for Deutsche Bank and whatever I said, you're going to report it as, well, Deutsche Bank said. So they're not allowed to speak. Our CEO is Ashley Warren. He, you know, worked for the banks and set up the dealing desks, you know, for the last 30 years. He left, came to our company, and the first thing he said is, at last, I can say what I think.
Isn't J.P. Morgan, you know, the trading desk of J.P. Morgan, as well as Goldman, I mean, aren't they really the advisors currently to the U.S. government?
The firms are, but you think that they're ever going to give any advice whatsoever that is against their own firm? No. You can't be the market maker and the advisor. And, I mean, I'll tell you, all right, when you had the 07 crash and going down, you know, one of the questions I was actually asked by a member on the banking committee? Why did Lehman and Bear Stearns fall in 24 hours? I said, repo. He said, repo, what's that? I said, would you regulate? I can't make up this stuff.
And the irony is, you might remember that the one of the guys who worked on the J.P. Morgan desk, the derivatives desk back in the 90s, they were selling those derivatives and filling up their balance sheets with these toxic mortgage-backed securities and leveraged derivatives. And they knew that any side of the trade would blow up. It didn't matter to them because they got their huge commissions. And Orange County, goodbye.
I wrote a piece, you can find it on our website, it's called Transactional Banking. People don't realize what happened. When the Clintons repealed Glass-Steagall, what did it really do? It changed banking forever. Before then, a bank would lend you money. Let's say if I was the banker and you have your business, then I would come down, take a look, kick the tires, gee, how are things going, everything all right, look at your books. All right, okay, you need a little bit more, we'll give it to you. Looks like you're doing good. That was relationship banking. The Clintons changed that. Removing Glass-Steagall became transactional banking. Now, all of a sudden, they pulled, okay, I'll lend you money on your house. I could care less if you pay. I just need a whole bunch of stuff, throw it in this pot, because I'm selling the pot. All right? So it became transactional banking. This is why, you know, there was no inflation, this hyperinflation from the Fed buying and all the rest of the nonsense. Why? Because the banks put the money right back in excess reserves. They didn't lend it out. They're not doing relationship banking. 70% of small businesses are turned down for loans. All right? It's transactional. I will basically lend you money and 10 guys on the same street because I'm going to package it up together and I'm going to sell it off to somebody else. It's off my books. Their argument to the Clintons, why to get rid of Glass-Steagall, it will make us stronger. We won't have the risk on our books. And they go, oh, okay, great. Yeah, that sounds good. The U.S. banks are far better than you have in Europe. They don't have tons of bad loans. Why? Because they sold them. We're in transactional banking. This is no longer relationship banking. That's like, you know, 25 years ago. Things have changed. So, you know, the banks there, they're only going to tell the government what to do if they make a profit out of it. That's why we get called in all the time. We're not making markets. I'm going to tell you straight up this, that, the other thing. You know, I don't have an interest if you buy this product. Oh, it's going to do this. Oh, here, I'll say you this. There's none of that pitching. Comes to our World Economic Conferences, they're shocked. It's like, you're not trying to sell us something. No, you're paying a lot of money for a seat to find out what's really happening. My lawyer told me that I used to live up in New Jersey, and he said if I died, tell my family to drag my body across the river before they tell anybody. And my accountant made me sign in blood that I would be out of New Jersey. California has a 13.5% state income tax, probably going up to 15 soon. California doesn't even recognize if you retire. They don't lower it. The Bureau, you know, a census, the two states everybody is going to is Texas and Florida. That's it. The two states without state income tax. You're making the forecaster into a Hollywood movie. I just got the script. And I do know that they will do a private funding for that. Usually movies, Hollywood movies, are funded by the bankers. But since this is kind of anti-banking, they want to do private funding, not go to Wall Street.
Who's going to play you? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I don't.
Get George Clooney.
I think it's the direction of, or decision of the director, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
They sent it out to a professional reader. They came back, this is fantastic. Everybody I sent it to, they said, they can't put it down.
Do you think then that it's going to be something along the lines like we saw with that, you know, Christian Bale, Brad Pitt, Steve Carell, about the housing bust?
Yeah, it's something more along those lines. I insisted that if you wanted to do this, then it has to be accurate. No fictitious stuff. So it's pretty much on point. Industry really does work, etc.
It's not going to be a Wolf on Wall Street. Have they actually sealed the deal? Will it be lucrative for you? I don't want to pry too much.
Largely getting the truth out. The Big Short was at least truthful. I think it wasn't done as well, you know, with a girl in bubbles trying to explain complex ideas. I think they spent too much time on that. They could have made it more simpler. But as opposed to like Wall Street with Michael Douglas, you know, it was very nice, but it wasn't insider trading. The guy's father was a janitor, and it was a good guess. It wasn't a board of directors or anything like that. And The Wolf of Wall Street, you know, that was just the low-end bucket shops. There hasn't been really a film about the real industry. The Big Short was the first one that was even remotely coming close. But I think it could have been done a little bit better, but everybody I know in the industry went to go see it. They said, yeah, it's on point. They didn't really emphasize a lot that the fact that banks wouldn't make markets until they recovered themselves. That's really what happened. But they didn't make a big deal of that. But I don't think that they saw how it would collapse as rapidly. And the problem was that there was no central clearinghouse. So if one bank you called up and they were the market makers and the bank is losing money, they're not going to make markets for you when they're down themselves.
Hey, did you get the news that Fed head announced that it's the end of all market crises? If that's not a red flag.
I don't know. I mean, it's what I mean. You're appointing people that are academics. They have no trading experience whatsoever. When I got called into the Brady Commission, I didn't want to go. They started lobbying all my friends and said, listen, because they were blaming computer trading. And even Jack Swigger called me, Marty, look, you got to do this. You know, if you don't, they're going to come take all our computers from us. So I went in, you know, and the professor they put in charge of the investigation was Professor Gottlieb from, I think it was MIT or something. So I sat down, and first words are, all right, we're going to start this investigation. We're going to find the guy that shorted this market and forced it down. And I said to him, I said, excuse me. I said, do you realize that every investigation since 1907 has begun with the same statement, and they have never found anybody yet? And he's just looking at me, and what are you talking about? I said, that's not what makes markets go down. And he goes, well, I teach finances. Let's put the accolades aside. I said, how does it work? Well, I borrow stock from this one and I sell it to this one. I said, okay. So how is he ever going to outnumber the longs? And he's just looking at me. I said, let's talk about futures. Every contract's got to be matched. And he said, well, what makes it go down? I said, very simple. Everybody's long, all right, not short. They panic. They try to sell, and there's no bid.
I've seen that in the futures market. I've seen no bid.
Because the short is the only one who's going to have courage to buy in it when something's crashing like that. Europe, they've outlawed short selling, naked short selling. They have no clue what these people have done. I mean, you need the naked short because he's the only one who's going to provide support in a crash. And that's why the stock market went down 90% in the 20s, because what happened was they were subpoenaing everybody in Rockefeller, whatever, and they were grilling them in the Senate, you know, to find out they were looking for the short player, and they found out how much everybody lost. So you wouldn't go short, because if you went short, you would be subpoenaed.
Yeah, then the big plunger himself was actually buying, making a market. That was his big argument. You remember Livermore, you know, he said, shorting? No, I'm covering my short positions. I'm making a market. I'm saving you.
Without the short player, there's no bid. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to step up and say, I'll buy when, you know, everything's going nuts.
But what do you say about companies? I mean, there were some really fantastic companies like Webvan, you know, that would deliver groceries to people who really needed it, folks with disabilities, seniors, Alzheimer's, dementia, war veterans. And, you know, Webvan had a pretty solid business model. They were just naked shorted into oblivion. We saw that with Sirius. I think it was Sirius. That was shorted, and it was all naked short. That has a deleterious effect. Sure, they uncover the weaknesses for the rest of us.
The stock wouldn't have gone down if it was solid. A short can't push. I've watched this stuff trading over the years, and, I mean, there's something wrong if the stock falls apart. And the short who's going to come in naked like that, he probably knows something. And it's just not being revealed. I mean, if you have a really solid business model and you're doing well, it doesn't matter. Outside the country, we were always big in currency. And, oh, back in the 80s when I was going to first open up offices overseas, I met with one of our clients who became a friend of mine. He was the head of the UBS back then in Switzerland. So we went to lunch in Geneva, I remember. And I asked him, I said, oh, here are a few names we were going to use, European advisors, this, that, and the other thing. And he asked me, he says, name one European analyst. And I was really embarrassed because I couldn't. And I'm thinking, well, I'm sure there are. I just don't know any. And he laughed and he says, no, there are none. And he says, you want to know why everybody uses you? He says, that's why. And I said, why? I don't understand it. Everybody comes to you because he taught me a lot. And why we became the biggest advisors internationally was because outside this country, World War II, German politician would stand up and say, vote for me, see the Deutschmark's up now 25 cents against the dollar. They used it as a validation point that they've done a good job. So currency became intertwined with politics. I mean, there isn't one bank, and I get emails all the time from all the, I say the Euro, ECB is going to fail or whatever. Can you imagine if Deutsche Bank came out and said something like that? They would be cut off by the ECB. What happens is nobody can talk. I have the experience internationally. There's other people like me, but they can't speak. So it ends up in that sort of situation. The reason is that even the governments, they want to know sometimes the truth. You can earn $5 million a year, and you put out studies for them, for every bill that has to pass, all right? But they tell you what it's supposed to say. So Obamacare is going to pass. Okay, we need a study, and it's got to say this, 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 this. Okay, fine, and you write it. Oh, an expert wrote this. So I said, look, I'm not interested in doing that. So I have a business that's global, and we tell the truth, all right? So that everybody knows it's not bought and paid for. So what happens is when every time there's a crisis, I'm the one the governments come to. They don't go to the ones that they already pay because they know they can't even give them the truth.
The reason why they come to you, because they subscribed with you. I'll bet you have someone from every one of our 16 or 18 agencies, the DOD, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI. That's why they're coming to you.
Oh, yeah. Look, we had our Hong Kong office. The British government bought four seats and came over to that incognito. You know, even they need to know the truth at times. And so, I mean, when, you know, the 89 crash, when Tokyo was crashing, I had, you know, the U.S. Treasury on one phone and the Central Bank of Canada on the other, simultaneously. I mean, then I was like, well, should we intervene? What do you think? They are just like us. They don't know what to do. But they put out a persona that they really know things. I mean, I can tell. I mean, I would get a call maybe once a quarter from the Fed. When it starts getting every month and then every couple of weeks, I know what's going on.
How do you rate Paulson, the Treasury? I mean, obviously he was calling all the shots. Do you think that without someone like a heavy hitter like Paulson behind the scenes that we will be facing another 2008-2009?
I mean, he deliberately withheld any help whatsoever for Lehman or Bear. And the reason, Bear was not involved. So what happened was they refused to participate in the bailout. And so they were the ones that refused to participate, and Goldman was pissed off about them for doing that.
Who bails out their enemies?
Paulson let Lehman go down and Bear go down, and the very next day bails out an insurance company, no authority to do. Why? Because that would have taken down Goldman.
AIG. They would have taken down the whole system. I mean, that thing was a behemoth. Yeah, but with no Paulson at the helm, I still wonder what they're going to do when this whole edifice implodes.
I mean, I was actually asked by the House Banking Committee to write the questions to ask the Fed when they testify. Okay, fine, I'll do it. One of the questions I penned down, I said, here. I said, you know, I want these questions asked. I said, okay, if the euro fails, what is your contingency plan? Well, the website is armstrongeconomics.com. Our Frankfurt conference will be July 22nd, and that is going to be focused really just on Europe. They really want to know what's happening over there. We have extremely large client base in Germany. We're going over there basically to service our clients. We have the German elections coming up in October, so everybody really is like on eggshells over there in Europe.
Exactly. All right. Well, we're going to look forward to hearing more about, you know, just what items you purchased from robots at the Frankfurt Airport on your next trip. Thanks, Martin Armstrong.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.